The enormity of the issue of climate change can almost paralyze the mind. You can grasp the idea of rising sea levels and truly hot days, but it's easy to wonder, what can I do? Our guest this hour answered that question for himself, and the answer in his case is plenty. Peter Kalmus harks back to the expression, be the change you want to see in the world, with the title of his book, Being the Change. Live well and spark a climate revolution. Peter Kalmus is a scientist working on climate change. To be specific, he's an atmospheric scientist working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, a NASA facility. Peter Kalmus, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Jeff, thanks so much for having me.
You apparently were well along in your studies for a PhD when you learned the basic science of global warming. Was it a real hit you upside the head moment?
Yeah, pretty much. It kind of gradually got more and more intense. I was working on a PhD in physics at Columbia at the time, and I was studying to be either a cosmologist or to study gravitational waves. I hadn't decided at the time. And I just started learning more and more about global warming, reading more and more scientific papers. A scientist came and gave a talk about radiative forcings at a physics colloquium when I was a graduate student, and I was just I walked out of there thinking, man, this is really serious stuff. We got to do something about this. And I was surprised by, you know, my colleagues didn't have the same reaction. You know, mostly they kind of took it in stride and kept working on their physics, and I couldn't really understand that. My mind just kind of went more and more towards learning about the climate science.
So yeah, it sounds like you were starting to preach the gospel of global warming just a bit to people, and but nobody was really taking you up on it.
Yeah, well, at the time, I hadn't started changing my own life, so I was still flying around a lot. I was still flying to lots of scientific conferences and collaboration meetings. I was living in Manhattan actually, so I didn't have a very large carbon footprint besides from my flying around, but I hadn't really, made a conscious effort to examine how my lifestyle played into global warming, and I hadn't started changing it. So, when you haven't really started changing your own life, and you're kind of like shaking people by the lapels and asking them to wake up, and you haven't really woken up yourself, it's not a very compelling argument, I guess, for other people to change.
But in the short term, you stuck with physics, didn't you? I mean, you actually turned down a chance to work with James Hansen at NASA?
Yeah, it took a while for me to change my mindset and really kind of embrace, aligning my life and my outward actions with this deepening awareness of a crisis. So, I was working for LIGO. I was really excited about gravitational waves. My career was looking really good. I had a really great offer from Caltech, in the Pasadena area. And to be honest, I'd lived in New York City for about 8 years, and I was ready for a change. I had a lot of questions. I wasn't sure what a career in atmospheric science or climate science would look like at that point. It kind of hit me. The job offer came pretty suddenly, and I just wasn't quite ready for it. So I kind of, I don't know. I wouldn't say I regret it, but I think I would have moved to the path that I'm on now 4 years earlier, which would have been, really helpful for me. So
we should be pointing out in fairness to you that gravitational waves turned out to be a very big deal not long after you switched out of it, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it was hard for me to I left the collaboration a couple of years before that discovery, and it was hard for me to sit on the sidelines, and I was thrilled by the discovery, and but I wasn't really a frontline participant like I would have been if I'd stayed in the collaboration. I would earnestly love a world that didn't have global warming. So, I love doing any kind of science, and I love atmospheric science, and it's amazing studying the planet. In some ways, maybe more amazing than studying astrophysics, but yeah, it would be great if I didn't have to sit on the sidelines for that event. But I felt like climate science was way too urgent, and it was actually not that hard to switch into it. And I thought that there would be a cascade of scientists coming in from other fields, but that didn't turn out to be the case. But I felt much better after I made the switch, because then I spend my full working day thinking about these problems instead of kind of moonlighting as a climate scientist. And, you know, it just became increasingly difficult to focus on gravitational waves. So I just knew I had to make the switch.
You sound really rather called to dealing with climate science. I mean, that you realize that the world needs people to be as dedicated as you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that what we have is a, I don't think it's too hyperbolic to say that we have a climate emergency. And I would say we need all hands on deck. So, you know, if people are talented in sciences, you know, I would urge them to consider making the switch and you know, pushing the science. If people are talented as artists or as writers, you know, or as maybe policymakers, they can get involved in ways that capitalize on their own talents and experiences and networks.
So figure out what your skill is and apply it to climate science as best you can.
Or to you know, making progress on the problem of global warming as best you can, for sure.
All right, we'll come back and talk more with Peter Kalmus. Lots to talk about, obviously, when we talk about global warming. His book is called Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. He made some significant changes in his own life, and we'll get into the details of what that was when he moved from Manhattan to Southern California. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Kalmus and Being the Change and your phone calls and emails in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Be the change you want to see in the world. The quote is attributed to Gandhi. He apparently said several somewhat longer sentences and they got squished into a bumper sticker. But nonetheless, Peter Kalmus heeded the advice and he changed his own behavior in a big way. He is a scientist working on climate change at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He wrote a book called Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, in which he lets us know how he changed his own life. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about ways in which we can change our carbon footprint. He did it by a factor of 10. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Peter, talk about moving to Southern California from New York. Altadena sounds like a totally different landscape from what you'd seen in Manhattan.
Yeah, so in Manhattan, I was living in a tiny apartment, and you know, I didn't have any connection to the earth. Sometimes when it was raining outside, I could barely tell, you know, when the windows were closed because the subway was going by and so on. And so that's part of why I was kind of ready to leave Manhattan. And then when I moved to Altadena is this beautiful little community, which is kind of nestled up against the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains. So it has, you know, a lot less traffic than the rest of the Los Angeles area. It has a lot of people with chickens and goats and a lot of gardening going on here. So when I moved here, I had a little house with a tiny little plot of land. And I didn't know the first thing about plants or growing food. But, you know, I chose the house because it had an amazing avocado tree in the backyard. And I had a few other fruit trees, you know, some of which I think I killed by underwatering shortly after I moved here. But then I started growing tomatoes. And it just was so much fun to, you know, I would sit by the tomatoes before I went to work a little bit and see how they were growing and just enjoy the smell of the vines. And then it just kind of went on from there. I started planting fruit trees. I think I have maybe 30 fruit trees now. The figs are totally ripe and delicious, and I've got persimmons getting ripe. I've got apples on the trees. There's some pomegranates that are getting ripe. And it just kind of, you know, to me it's sort of a miracle that fruit grows on trees. And I just, you know, from someone who grew up in Chicago and then went to school in Boston and then lived in Manhattan for 8 years. It was kind of a revelation. So I just really love growing food. It tastes better to me. It's very satisfying to me to watch it grow. To see a happy plant, it makes me happy. You know, it's just a visceral thing. There's really no intellectualism about that at all. It just makes me really happy to see a happy plant.
So the outward practices, the things you're doing with your hands and with your land and your plants, I mean, there are inward things going on too. You mentioned that meditation played a part in your changes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the book is, I think it's kind of an interesting synthesis of science, practical action, and, you know, I guess scientists have a kind of an aversion to saying this word, but I guess you could say spirituality. Global warming, and by the way, I heard your weather report. Sounds like you're having quite the heat wave up there.
Oh, yeah, with the highest temperatures in 35 years.
Yeah, by the way, that's going to get worse. there is one study that I cite in the book that said by 2014, heat waves in general were about 10 times as likely as they were just in 2004. And so that's probably, yeah, now it's 2017, so it's probably even more likely. So I mean, this is what really motivates me. I've got two young boys, and, you know, until we stop burning fossil fuels, there's no end in sight. You know, sometimes my boys do youth soccer, and I coach them, and sometimes we go to games, and it's almost too hot to play. And it kind of, you know, it breaks my heart to see the other parents and the kids playing. And I get the sense that people don't, maybe at some level they don't realize that something hasn't changed and then we're at like a new plateau. You know, things are actively changing and possibly accelerating and getting worse. So with something that huge and you know, there's more than 7 billion people on the planet, you know, and some of us are contributing more than others in like rich Western countries. But such a huge thing that I don't see how you can approach it without some kind of spiritual component. So, you know, meditating, I guess you could say I'm a pretty serious meditator. I try to do an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. And that helps me, I guess you could say, stay grounded and, you know, keep from being emotionally overwhelmed by all of this, you know. Sometimes I feel a sense of grief. At this point, maybe it's worth stopping and saying that, you know, I think in the book and in this conversation, I'm speaking as a scientifically informed human being.
Mm-hmm.
And as a parent. I should also say, too, just that, you know, I'm not speaking on behalf of NASA or the Jet Propulsion Laboratory or Caltech.
Okay.
But, you know, how can something that changes how we live, changes how we relate to the biosphere, affects our kids, you know, is a major contributor to the sixth mass extinction. I mean, it's just such an existential thing that it calls for some kind of practice to allow us to keep moving forward and keep doing what we can, you know, to work from a place of kind of positivity instead of a place of negativity.
Peter Kalmus is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a scientist working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. His book is Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. You ended up with a new term called bicycling. What is bicycling?
Yeah, well, that was going to be the original title of the book, but we decided that didn't really work as a title, you know, to coin a new phrase like that. But I do mention it in the introduction. The idea is that, you know, you're closing these natural cycles that I think capitalism and like industrial capitalism has kind of taken things that are cyclical in nature, like the food production and then the composting is sort of a cycle. And it's kind of, in order to extract profit, it's sort of cut that cycle and made it a linear thing, where now instead, like nature recycles everything naturally. The recycling that we do is just like a very pale, it's a tiny little thing compared to what nature does. You know, now we produce things and then send it to a landfill, so that's kind of this linear flow. So it's looking at my own life and seeing how can I kind of reconnect these cycles in my own life kind of in every moment, and how is what I'm doing in this moment either contributing to the problem or the predicament that we have, or helping us come out of it, pulling us back from it. So that's where the bee cycling comes from. Bee, like my own self. How am I, you know, these cycles, how am I part of these cycles, and how am I, you know, contributing to sort of a new story where we reconnect these things.
And there's a really interesting observation here that you can change the world, but you can't save it. Could you explain the difference there?
Yeah, so I was growing increasingly frustrated by this sense that I got from mainstream environmentalism that, you know, we need to save the world, or this idea of a climate hero. I personally find that sort of mentality has a lot of ego in it, and also just feels too overwhelming. Like if I felt like I had to save the world, I wouldn't even know where to start. But, you know, every little thing I do is changing the world. I have an impact on my family. I have an impact on this tiny little, you know, tenth of an acre plot of land that my house sits on. I have an impact on my friends. You know, maybe by writing this book, the impact broadens a little bit. So, you know, I think everything we do, in some sense, you know, smaller or larger sense, is changing the world. And so if you think of just changing the world for the better, it helps keep you from getting overwhelmed. But I think that we all need to pull together, you know, all 7 point whatever billion of us need to pull together if we're going to, you know, prevent the worst of catastrophic climate change from happening.
So it's clear that you don't get discouraged, and also not turned off by terminology. Some things, like going green in the corporate sense, is not particularly palatable to you. You make clear in the book, but you don't mind using the term global warming on a regular basis, where just about everybody else has embraced climate change, and you don't mind at all the use of the term low energy, which obviously, particularly with last year's Republican presidential debates, has some connotations attached to it.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess I'm not really an expert in marketing, and, you know, I don't really always think about the implications of these words. I try to, but, you know, I try to just tell it like it is in the most straightforward way that I can. I mean, to me, global warming just means the global average surface temperature of the planet is gradually increasing, and that's exactly what's happening. So to me, it's a very accurate term. It is an example of climate change. You know, the climate has changed many times over the course of the Earth's history. So sometimes the climate gets warmer, sometimes it gets cooler. So I think that that's a more general term. But what's specifically happening right now, I think maybe the most specific term you could use is anthropogenic climate change. It's climate change caused by human activity. So, yeah, I don't see any problem with using that term.
Peter Kalmus, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He's written about his own life in the book Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, also a feature documentary by that title. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a phone call from Pam in Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Well, I like what Richard, I think it's Richard Heimberg that calls it the long emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really hard for people to kind of get their minds around something that isn't immediate. Like if your house is on fire, you know, you see there's a problem, you get out. If there's a floodwaters coming through your door, you see the emergency, you take care of it. And this is a long emergency. It's been, you know, basically they identified it in the 1800s. Even if we stop burning fossil fuels today, we're going to still have increasing global warming. And I think a lot of people, it's just hard to wrap their minds around the whole crisis that we're actually in right now. But I wanted to call a little bit. I had found out that you can buy used Nissan Leafs for a very affordable price, so I went and got myself one. So I have a 100% electric car, and I can plug it into Cafe M in Eugene and get solar electric, charge my car with solar electric. And then some friends of mine, after I bought one, I bought mine for $11,000, I saw one for $7,000, and my friends bought one, and they're sharing it with their friends. So when they need to go out of town where the range is more than the 80 miles, you know, both ways, 40 miles each way, they use their friend's vehicle, and then they share their electric vehicle with their friends. So there's all kinds of really creative ways that we can, you know, lower our carbon footprint and be conscious consumers. And I think that's a huge part. And then also, the whole relocalization. I think if people understood that when you buy something in the grocery store, the average miles it travels is 1,500. That's just ridiculous. And it's I really like the idea of natural capitalism that includes all the costs of bringing a product to your house or your home or whatever.
And
a product
included.
So that, you know, you couldn't buy an apple from New Zealand and have it be cheaper than the one 5 miles down the road, which is what our current system is.
All right.
So I just wonder if you have some responses to those ideas and what you think about sharing electric vehicles, because where I live in the country, transportation, mass transit doesn't work. So
I'm sure. Okay, thanks.
Thanks for doing what you can. I've been doing it for 20 years and ringing the bell.
Thanks, Pam.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Pam. Great comments. So a couple of things pop immediately into my mind. One is I like the idea of, finding ways to live a less carbon-intensive life as creatively as possible. I love that word. I think that so what I've found with the things that I've done, a lot of the changes I've made, is that they've made me happier. So I would urge people to actually try to quantify how much carbon dioxide they're emitting in a year. And, you know, in the book, I think I do try to make it as easy as possible for you to do that in a way that really connects the carbon emissions to your lifestyle, you know, like how many miles you drive, how much electricity you use, how much you fly, and so on. So if you quantify it, then that gives you a picture of what you're using. And then get as creative as you can to reduce that. And I think that if you employ your own creativity, especially in conjunction with your neighbors, Pam mentioned, you know, sharing electric vehicles, for example, I think that people will find that it actually increases their sense of community. It increases their sense of connection. It'll make them feel like they're doing something really meaningful, and we all want to have a sense of purpose in our lives. That way, these kinds of changes will be sustainable. So everyone's going to gravitate towards different things. Everyone's going to get excited by different things. People's carbon dioxide emissions, everyone's going to look a little bit different when they actually go and quantify that. So that's why I think, like, what Pam might do, what might make sense for her, might look a bit different than what really makes sense for me. And the second thing that really struck me about Pam's comments was this sense of in capitalism, there's a market failure where that apple from New Zealand can actually cost less than a local organic apple. And that's a real problem. Same thing with a gallon of gasoline. It's incredibly cheap here compared to a lot of countries. And when we burn that fossil fuel, there's a lot of costs that aren't included in the price of the fossil fuel. Costs, for global warming right now, global warming, 100 years from now that we're passing on to our children, costs to non-humans that are going extinct. So these, I guess you could call them societal costs, need to be included in all of the capitalistic transactions that we do.
For that matter, too,
to do that is to put a price on carbon.
Well, and to do that in our own lives, Peter, I just found myself wondering that as you count up the ways in which we tend to use fossil fuels, the lights we leave on, all that sort of thing, do we include our work life there? Because, I mean, I'm sitting here talking on 11 radio stations at once and thinking that's a lot of power that I'm in part of using.
We should. I mean, everything's connected. I didn't look at – I think I included my computer use at work, but there's more than just computer use. You know, there's, for example, my office is air conditioned at work. I think if you take a step back and look at the picture in a broader sense, will always be people who don't want to reduce their own fossil fuel use voluntarily, and there's always going to be systematic issues that make it really hard for an individual to reduce. For example, not having good public transportation, maybe not having good bike lanes. There's a million things that an individual can do, but everything would be way easier if the system started to change to support these individual actions. And one way that you can encourage these kinds of systematic changes across the board, as well as encouraging and incentivizing individual action, is to have a gradually increasing price on carbon emissions. And you know, a lot of people are starting to talk about this now. I think the best thing to do with the revenue that would be collected from that gradually rising fee would be to simply return it to the people as a dividend. That's sort of the controversial part. The reason that's a good thing to return it to the people is then it's a progressive policy as opposed to a regressive policy. So since, you know, richer people use more fossil fuels, 70% of households would come out ahead under such a policy. And it would also actually create jobs and even improve the economy. So it's kind of a no-brainer, I think, to do a carbon price. And if it's done right, it could really help a lot.
All right, carbon pricing, one of many ideas being talked about in the world today. Peter Kalmus lived some of the things that we need to do to make the climate better. Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution is his book. We'll come back and talk more about it when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Peter Kalmus, a scientist working on climate change at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. He's written a book about his own life's perspective, though, about the ways in which he wanted to change his own behavior to feel better about what he's doing for the world and demonstrate that we all can do it. His book is called Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 to get in by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So we've been fairly theoretical so far. I want to get into some more of the specifics about what you did. You took your life in your hands, it sounds like, and decided to bike a lot in Southern California.
Yeah, that was one of the first changes that I made. You know, I don't, if you're smart about it, I don't think it's as dangerous as most people think. Though that, you know, that said, you have to be very, very careful. And, you know, there's some things that you can do to lower risk, such as if you're riding at night to use lights. You know, a lot of accidents actually are caused by night riders who don't use lights. But, you know, there's some studies which I was kind of floored by this when I was researching the book. If you take heart disease, you know, heart attacks and strokes mm-hmm. into account, just having a very short commute, like of a couple of miles every day, greatly reduces your overall, I guess you could call it all-cause mortality. So this is kind of an actuarial thing. Actuarial studies look at, you know, deaths by different causes, including, you know, getting hit by a car versus having a heart attack or stroke. And on average, in a statistical sense, you'll live far longer if you ride a bike. But that's not why I do it. I do it because I just love doing it. It keeps me healthy, which is huge when you're a middle-aged guy like me with kids. And it's just happy. You know, it's one of the, I guess you could say my commute to the lab is one of my the happiest times of the day. You know, a lot of my coworkers are sitting in traffic, and I'm basically riding over a dam and riding through this little park, and it's just such a joy, you know, to ride a bike.
Wow, about a 6-mile commute. Is that what you said in the book?
Well, that was what it was when I was working at Caltech, and Now that I'm working at JPL, unfortunately, it's only a 2-mile commute each way.
Wow,
which isn't quite enough. So I do a lot of errands. You know, when I need to go to the hardware store, I ride my bike. So there's this. It's interesting how all of these things connect together. So there's a Home Depot, which is I think it's about maybe 12 miles away, but, you know, we kind of have to take the freeway to get there, and it wouldn't be a very fun bike ride at all. And then there's a little hardware store in downtown Altadena, which is about 2 miles away from my house. And so, of course, I go there. And so biking, you know, you're supporting local businesses, too. And I think that's a surprising connection that maybe not a lot of people would make.
Transportation, you can make a lot of changes, I noticed, because it's not just that you're biking a lot more, but you mentioned earlier about flying to scientific conferences and stuff. And do you do that at all anymore?
No, I haven't flown in several years. I haven't flown since I switched to atmospheric science, actually, about 5 years ago. That was the biggest decrease in my own personal emissions. So in 2010, when I was flying about 50,000 miles a year, mostly for scientific meetings, it was about 75% of my total emissions. And that's being really generous to flying, actually. So, you know, that was a surprise to me. I didn't realize how big that impact was in my own life. And obviously, you know, a lot of people will fly less than I did, so it'd be less of a large impact to them. But I knew that, you know, whatever else I did, you know, if I was biking or if I turned vegetarian, or even if I did sort of more kind of alternative things, like my car runs on veggie oil, and I get a lot of my food from the waste stream, from, you know, supermarket discards. So even doing those kinds of things that are more off the beaten track would be kind of meaningless if I was still flying 50,000 miles a year. So over a couple of years, I ramped that down to zero. And that, you know, that meant that my parents live in the suburbs of Chicago, and my wife's mom lives in western Illinois. So unfortunately, that's 2,000 miles away from Los Angeles, so that was one of the motivators for me to switch my car to run on veggie oil.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to go to Illinois when we make the trip. We either drive in the Greasemobile or else we take the train, which is kind of fun because it's just kind of fun to take the train. The kids love it, and I get a lot of work done on the train because there's actually...
You got room to sit down for one, and yeah.
Yeah, and there's no internet, actually, which is kind of surprising because I think even a lot of the buses these days have internet. But I kind of love it because if I prepare ahead of time and, you know, get a collection of papers that I need to read and get ready to work on a paper that I'm trying to finish up, you know, or even on one of the trips I did a lot of writing for the book. So it's just kind of a fantastic time to, like, really get into something deeply.
You mentioned that you've been burning used cooking oil in the car. So I wonder if your garage and its environs a little greasy from the burned oil.
Wait, can you repeat that?
Is the garage a little greasy from the burned oil? I mean,
it's a garage. Well, yeah, I actually don't keep the car in the garage. But yeah, I did keep some of the oil in the garage sometimes, and I tend to keep it in these the plastic 5-gallon jugs that the oil comes in for the restaurants.
Uh-huh.
And that wasn't a great idea because they would fail from time to time and get some veggie oil on the ground. But it's not nearly as big a deal as you know, some other, you know, maybe it's like motor oil. You know, it's just... over the course of a year, it kind of just, I don't know if bacteria eat it or what happens, but it essentially goes away.
Wow. Okay, let's take another call here from Judy in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Kalmus, the author of Being the Change.
Hi.
Hi.
We own a small construction company. We buy old houses and rehab them and then rent them. In the process, we need a new truck. Our truck is over 10 years old now, and I'm wondering what the best choice is. Here, I don't think we have a good source of biofuel, so I'd otherwise buy a diesel and change it to biofuels, but we don't have a good source for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so advice on shopping for an eco-friendly truck in a place that is not in Southern California, for example. Peter Kalmus, what kind of advice can you offer?
Well, it's interesting. There's a place in Corvallis called EnviroFuel, you know, I've been there, and one of the owners is actually a really good friend, the sister of a really good friend of mine, and they could, you know, I would just recommend, you know, if you don't feel like you can do it yourself, the conversion, to talk to them. And they'll help you.
Okay. So before we leave transportation, I want to ask a question that you pose here, because you say that people do bring this up. The people who insist they're still flying because they say, well, the plane would still be there flying without me.
Yeah, I get that one a lot. Well, you know, that kind of leads to this question of how individual action relates to kind of broader collective action or systematic change. You know, the fact is there's a lot of different ways of looking at that specific problem. But, you know, as more and more people buy tickets, the airlines aren't stupid. They're not going to fly planes that they don't need to fly. So that the collective, you know, customers buying tickets sets the number of planes. There might be one individual that buys the kind of the magic ticket that causes the next plane to fly, but nobody knows who that is. So it doesn't, you know... So the sensible thing to do is to just take that airplane flight and divide it, you know, divide the emissions by the number of people that are on the flight. There's really no other way to look at it.
So how do you get the basic messages across, though? I mean, because obviously that's a specific sort of thing where people are saying, well, the plane would fly without me. But, you know, the fewer planes might fly if fewer people flew, obviously. But just in general, the idea that this is a world where all good developments tend to be measured in growth. I've got more stuff. Our economic growth is 2.6% in the last quarter, et cetera, et cetera. How do you get people to latch onto the idea of actually doing less?
Well, that's a great question. I think that's maybe kind of the crux of the whole matter. So when I talk about fee and dividend, the carbon fee and dividend, that assumes that, you know, it's working with this existing system of I guess what you could call industrial capitalism. So I think that's one way to take the existing system of growth-based industrial capitalism and try to close this huge leak that's in it that's basically killing the planet through carbon emissions. That's only the first step, though. You know, I personally feel that there's kind of no way around in the long term for to have a sustainable human presence on this planet. I think we have to get away from this idea of constant growth, and we have to move toward a steady-state population and a steady-state economy that doesn't grow. Some economists talk about decoupling, that we can have economic growth without using more physical resources, but I don't think that's true. I mean, even information, like organizing and processing information, takes energy. That energy is a physical resource that has to come from somewhere. So, you know, if you have something that's growing exponentially at 2 or 3% a year, it doesn't take very long, you know, maybe a couple of centuries before you get to these really absurd things where, you know, for example, just the energy that you're using could cause the surface of the planet, forget global warming, but just the energy that you're using through thermodynamics could cause, you know, the planet to get so hot that a glass of water would boil. So it just seems really clear to me as a physicist, I guess, and that if you're in this finite system and the Earth, we now really, you know, a few hundred years ago, I don't think we saw it as a finite system, but now it's become excruciatingly clear that it is a finite system. You can't have exponential growth indefinitely in a finite system. You just can't. And it's not clear to me how to move exactly to that steady state system. So I know that we need a fee and dividend now to fix the immediate hemorrhaging of the immediate emergency. And then we need to, you know, I think more and more we're going to start seeing discussions about how to move toward a steady state.
Well, so when it comes to population, though, I mean, do you have any thoughts about the carrying capacity of the Earth and whether we've already reached it?
It turns out to be a pretty hard question. And, of course, it depends a lot on, you know, assumptions. People say, well, if everyone switched to vegetarianism or veganism, we could have, you know, 7.5 billion people, or we could have more people. But I like to say, well, you know, humans are going to live the way humans are living. So, you know, if you have however many billion people living the way we live now, and maybe living more so as places like India and China start to eat more meat and start to drive more cars and whatnot and to take more airplane flights, how many humans can you have on this planet that are living this way? I think the planet's giving us ample signs that there are too many of us living this way right now, not just through global warming, but through, you know, all of the extinctions. The extinction rate right now is, I think, more than 1,000 times the pre-industrial or the background rate from before, you know, humans were destroying all the habitat for other species. You know, pollution's getting worse, air quality's getting worse. You know, cities are starting to become unlivable because of just burning fossil fuels. So it's hard to answer that question. Humans don't, you know, we've only started burning fossil fuels in the last couple of hundred years. If we weren't burning fossil fuels, you know, maybe we could have this many humans, but we are burning fossil fuels.
Number comes out different depending on what the practices are.
Yeah, well, you know, most experts who address the question of carrying capacity do think that there are too many humans right now. I tend to agree with them, and, you know, I think people don't like talking about that question, and I don't really have specific policies that I would suggest that we do, but You know, my wife and I, again, kind of taking it back to the individual level, we decided we had two kids, and we were thinking about having a third. And one of the main factors for not having a third was we didn't want to, go beyond the replacement rate. So if everyone had two kids, and I know that's not going to happen anytime soon, overpopulation would stop, and we would the population would gradually start to come back to a more sustainable level.
You mentioned your wife and kids. We just have a few seconds left. Are they totally on board with everything you're doing, or is there a little separation between you in terms of practices?
Well, that's a great question. They're totally on board in terms of riding bikes. My wife, if anything, loves riding bikes more than I do. She's essentially stopped flying, although maybe not to the same level as I have. She might still get on a plane, though she hasn't in a couple of years. She doesn't garden as much as I do, but she loves eating the food.
Okay.
We can leave it there.
All right, so it's pretty harmonious. The book is called Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. Peter Kalmus wrote it. He is a climate scientist working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, a NASA facility. Thanks so much for joining us today, Peter. Good to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. My pleasure.
All right, good. Take care.